Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, the brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg, and currently worn by world number 24, Jan-Lennard Struff, and world number 76, Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Use my code APPROVED, in all caps, at HollibertSports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. With Scope Fan Clubs, you can access premium behind-the-scenes content and chat with players that include world number 64, the Italian Flavio Caboli, and world number 25, Talon Griekspoor. You can put yourself in play for exclusive giveaways. These guys are on the move. See them at ScopeSports.io to see what they are all about. He grew up in Pasadena, California, and now resides in Hilton Head, South Carolina, where he has a robust tennis academy. He is a Wimbledon and U.S. Open winner, a former world number one, a Hall of Famer, and a true statesman of our game, and his name appears on the most iconic tennis shoe in the world. Stan Smith is today's guest. Are you in South Carolina?
I'm in South Carolina, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina.
You're in Hilton Head. You're at the Smith Stearns Academy. You're at your home?
I'm at my home, and I'll be there this afternoon at the Academy.
And the trophies behind, I see a Wimbledon plate. I see a U.S. Open cup. What else is back there? Is that all your stuff?
The Wimbledon cup is the gold one.
Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah. Wow.
And then the U.S. Open is the silver one.
Yep. I see that.
Right there. And then the plate is the centennial plate from Wimbledon. And then the Masters one is right next to the Wimbledon one.
And you're going to be on the court later? Is that what you're going to be doing?
Yeah, I go on the court from 2:30 to 4:30 every day that I'm here. And we've got about 45 kids that we work with. And it's a lot of fun.
For our listeners, the gentleman you hear, former world number one, Hall of Famer, former president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, the subject and author of Stan Smith, Some People Think I'm a Shoe, and the subject of a documentary that rolls out a week from today, a big theatrical release. And the name of that film is Who is Stan Smith? Ladies and gentlemen, Stan Smith is with us today.
You forgot to mention all my 17 grandchildren, you know, by name, which would be appropriate, but you can say that till later.
That's rough. I think, Stan, the last time I saw you was courtside at Ben Shelton, J.J. Wolf's match in Australia in 2023. We're going to talk about all that. As you know, we do a five-set format. The first set's the off-the-court report. I think we just hit it. Hilton Head is home. When will you be coming to California for the premiere of the film?
I'm coming on the 2nd of May, then going to New York on the 9th for the 10th. The 10th, the premiere in New York, and then the 14th here at Hilton Head.
Well, that's exciting. I mean, what's it like to have a documentary rolling out about you?
It's very strange. Very strange. It's always sort of awkward to see something like that, but that's what they've done. We had a great director and Danny Lee, who did a terrific job piecing all the different elements together.
Are you more comfortable watching it on a smaller screen, or is it seeing yourself on the big? Well, yeah, listen, you're a big star, Stan. I mean, you see yourself on a big screen all the time.
Not really. It's going to be interesting. We did something in New York about a year ago on a big screen, but this was for a film festival there.
And that documentary, the film premiered at Doc NYC. That was a great night for tennis. That was like a great New York night for tennis, wasn't it?
Well, it was. It's always fun to see New York embracing tennis.
Do you expect to have like a big splashy premiere next Friday in LA? Do you know, are any big hitters coming?
Well, we'll see. We've invited a few along the way, so we'll see how that works, but it should be a fun night.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report. This is where we talk about the business of tennis. As I said, you and I saw each other and I got to sit with you. We sat together to watch Ben Shelton more than a couple matches when he really splashed down hard in Australia in 2023. What are your impressions of him a year and a few months later?
Well, he's growing. He's growing in his game. I think he's understanding what he needs to do. He's got a great team and his father there, you know, I think it's one of the great father-son combinations, although, you know, who knows how it'll work. But Brian is terrific as a coach, and he's got a great perspective. He's played himself. He understands what it's all about. And he's been out there now. I guess they've been out there for a year and a half. And he's got a huge weapon in his serve and his forehand, and his backhand is solid. He volleys well, moves pretty well. I mean, that's one of the things I was wondering about when I first saw him play, to see if he could move well enough and to stay in the points long enough against these great ground strokers. He obviously can serve and volley off the court, a lot of guys, but on the slower courts and when you get into a rally, he's got to be able to extend it and be in good enough balance to be able to hit the good shots he needs to hit. And I love his progress. You know, his father, again, is not going for home runs right away, but wanting to develop slowly and thoroughly and hopefully get the most out of his game. I love the guy.
Have you chatted with Team Shelton and Ben and Brian? Have you talked to them a little bit?
Yes, I have. I did a little interview with Brian at an event at the Labor Cup, actually. Brian was there, and obviously Ben was playing there. And so we got some real insight. I knew Brian before, and I've talked to him quite a bit, but in fact, I worked with him, you know, when he was a junior. We had 10 of the top juniors in the United States down at Saddlebrook when we had the USTA Player Development Program. And one of the interesting things that happened there was we had a doctor check the shoulder strength of all these 10 boys, the top boys in the United States. And he was the only one that didn't have deficiency in the shoulder, which was an interesting thought. But he's a thorough guy, understands the game really well. And like I say, he's got a terrific perspective. It's going to be, I think that Ben's going to do as well as he possibly can do. That's all you can ask for.
Stan, first time we ever spoke, you were on my show in 2019 before a lot of things happened. And we were talking about players and you said liquid power. I'll never forget. It was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard. She said, oh, she has liquid power. He has liquid power. And you described it. And would it be fair to say that, you know, Ben kind of has that, at least with regards to the serve? You don't call it liquid. It's more explosive.
It's pretty explosive. It's not as smooth as a guy like Federer, but it is, you know, the liquid power comes from all the kinetic links of your body working together at the right time as efficiently as possible. And that's where you get the guy that looks like a Federer who's so effortlessly, but generates tremendous power. And Ben does everything. He's got a good knee bend, good shoulder turn, live arm, and he goes for his serve. He doesn't kind of just throw it in to start the point. And so he's one of those guys, when you're in the draw, you're looking to see where he is, because you don't want to have to play him early in a tournament and have to hopefully get a few serves back in play to be able to get a chance to win.
It's going to be interesting to see what he does on the clay too, if he can kind of play through the slowness.
Yeah, he's got obviously the clay courts are going to be a test for him. I mean, last year he played the clay courts for the very first time, European clay courts. He played grass for the very first time. And so Australia for the very first time. And obviously, he was used to the Australian courts, but the other courts are, you know, a new animal for him. And so I'm sure he learned a lot last year on the clay and on the grass as well.
Stan, you just mentioned it. You were in player development for the USTA many years ago. Just a couple weeks ago, Jose Higueras, Jose Higueras, wrote a letter expressing a lot of concern with the demise of American tennis as a result of budget cuts in player development. Would it be fair to say you read the letter?
I haven't read it thoroughly. I just heard about it. And I know Jose very well, and I know exactly where he stands. Uh, he he's the type of coach that wants players to come and train with him there if they can, or if whatever it is, whatever coach they're using, that they train a bit more instead of just playing, you know, matches. So I think that, you know, the only way players can really develop and get better is to, you know, work in training sessions when you're not playing tournaments. And that's been part of his philosophy. And he also has a great mind for, you know, how to prepare for big events and get the most out of your game. So I have tremendous respect for Jose and his ideas. So I just have heard a bit about the letter, but I don't know all the details.
Have you heard anything with regards to these budget cuts?
Yes. Yeah, I have. I know that there's been less money put into player development. I think there's a point of view that, you know, there's too much money going into it. There's not getting the results. The ROI isn't as good as it should be. So, you know, not do as much in that area. That could be a short-sighted, you know, point of view. I mean, you got to be efficient with the money you have. You got to, you know, make sure that you've got good coaches and you got a good program. We've had a good program going I think we've got a pretty good handful of players in the men's side and even on the women's side as well. But you got to keep it going. You got to keep the chain going.
When we talked again, you know, going back to this, you were concerned that the smaller tournaments were getting marginalized. They weren't making money. We talked about the 250s and the 500s having problems. And now, you know, the rubber has hit the road. 5 years later, you really knew exactly. It seemed like you almost told the future. I got ready for the interview listening to that. And the rubber has hit the road. They've already started whacking out the 500s and the 250s. Newport is essentially gone. What are your feelings about what's happening in tennis with regards to tournament schedules, money, et cetera?
It's sad to see these smaller tournaments not being successful. It's really the way that the chain of how you play the futures, then you go into qualifying the 250s, and then same with the 500s, and then they get to the 1,000 level and the Grand Slams. And it's, you got to have that path. Otherwise, players won't be able to make it. They'll just get discouraged, or they can't afford it, and so they're gone. So that's the overall situation, I think, worldwide with the tour. And then as an American, one of the saddest days of my life was to see the LA tournament go. That's 10 years ago. And that was, where I first really got to see some great tennis, see the professionals performing there. And LA was the hotbed. I mean, there's so many great players that came out of LA going back to the 30s, you know, and certainly I was there, Arthur, Dennis Rolfe. I mean, there's so many players in the men's and women's side that came out of LA. To see that tournament go was really sad. And of course, since then, we've lost a lot of American tournaments. We used to have, 10 or 15, pretty high level tournaments. Now we've got a handful, and that's not good for the American players, and certainly not good for, our worldwide program as well.
Do you think that this Saudi investment is interesting?
Yeah, that's a good word. I mean, there's a lot of words there. I hate what's happened in golf, and it seems to be a precursor to what could be happening in tennis. I know there's a lot going on behind the scenes as we speak with the ATP Tour, with even the slams. And so that's what happened with LA. LA didn't have the money. And in fact, we actually had a tournament in Canada while I was on the pro council. We had a tournament that wanted to put a lot of money in to become a major tournament. And we didn't allow it at that time. But a lot is happening. And, we have the great legacy of these terrific events. LA was one. But, the slams, of course, are the keystone to the whole tour. And when you see them being threatened by money and somebody just coming in and saying, we want to put up a lot, and the players have a hard time saying, we don't want it. And the women, I can't believe the women are playing there. It's even more surprising that the women would support that regime.
Seems like the money always wins. Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. The first time we spoke, we went through it. I wasn't nearly as prepared as I am now, now that I've seen the documentary. And I'm actually headed up to Ojai today. And I know that that was a big... Yeah, I'm on my way to Ojai shortly. Once I finish this interview, I'm going to voice it.
No kidding.
I'm going to say, tell me about Ojai.
Well, that could be my favorite tournament. I get emotional just thinking about it. I played there at 16 years old, and one of my biggest moments was losing to a good player from Southern California in a close match. And that was, you know, that was a big highlight to be able to play these good players. And that's when I had these goals. You may have seen in the documentary of you know, winning, you know, being on the Davis Cup, being number one in the U.S., winning Wimbledon, and being number one in the world. But it all started in Pasadena with the Pasadena Tennis Patrons, and they helped me, and they drove me up to Ojai. And so I lost there. Then I played in the college there, and we won that. The team did as well as I individually. Then we had an open division, which I played in, and that is really a special place. It was the start of my career, really.
You played there from 63 to 68. And 3 years later, you won the U.S. Open. I mean, so this Ojai, the Ojai was the real thing back then, huh?
Well, it was a big deal for a young guy who wasn't ranked very high in Southern California. I played in a private court when I lost that match to a guy named Jim Hobson, who was one of the top juniors in Southern California, one of the better players in the U.S. And for me to have such a good match against him, I said, well, maybe I can play a little bit. And I was still not one of the better players in the 16s and then the 18s, even in Southern California.
That's a cool place up there. And then from 64 to 68, you were in the winner's circle, either finaling or winning with Lutz, pretty much everything, huh? You guys were always right at the back end of that, huh?
We won the doubles a few times, and we might have even played each other in the finals of the singles, once or twice there. And in the college at that time, it wasn't a team event per se, I don't think, but we went there as a team and played. You know, George Tolley was our coach, and I remember him getting a little bit upset with Bob one time, not getting there for curfew.
That was a thing, right? Lutz was a little bit crazy and you were more reserved?
More or less, yeah. I was a little more serious about my game than Bob was really talented and did great, but was a little more, you know, relaxed about it.
Nastasi, you know, there's a funny thing happening here. Your documentary is rolling out, and Nastasi has a documentary rolling out that just got accepted into the Cannes Film Festival. Are you in touch with Ely by any chance?
Well, I did an interview for that documentary for him.
Oh, so you appear
in Paris last year.
Yeah.
And they invited me to come to Cannes for the film festival and just drop over and say hi. And I said, well, it's a little far for me to drop into. But
you know, you have a great story about Nastasi beating him at Wimbledon in the finals in 72. But those stories are the real thing. He was a wild cat, huh?
He was so talented. You know, the night before playing him, in fact, I had two nights before because it got rained out. The first for Saturday, and I had nightmares again, thinking about him, you know, chasing down all my volleys and hitting passing shots and being difficult to pass at the net. He was just he moved so well, and he had great instincts, and he used those instincts in many different ways, you know, to throw you off, and whether it be arguing with the umpire, with the linesman, joking around. A few times people said, gee, you don't joke around like he did. You know, you don't kind of enjoy his jokes and what he's doing on the court. And I said, well, if I get involved in that, I totally lose concentration. And that's part of his game. And it got to be more of his game as he got older to realize that, like I say, he had great instincts of how things affected other people. And so he used that to his advantage. And so you had to really stay focused if you could. And if you didn't, he'd beat you to death because he was so talented.
So good. We just referenced it. You know, the rubber has hit the road with regards to tennis being at this crossroads. You Arthur, Charlito, and Donald Dell were front and center when this all happened during the boycott of Wimbledon. This all happened when you guys created the ATP. I know you still talk to them. I'm sure that you still talk to them with a lot of significance. What have your conversations been like over the last year and a half?
Well, I just talked to Charlie yesterday, actually. He's going to come into the documentary in LA. And I think Joel Drucker is doing a book on him now. And so he was a great visionary himself and seeing where tennis was going. And he's one of the leaders of the ATP. And of course, he started the tournament in the Wells and really was had some great thoughts as we formed the ATP and as we grew and as what direction we should go. And it was very solid. Donald Dell was the same way. He had a huge impact on the game as a lawyer, representing players, running tournaments, being part of the fabric of the ATP as the general counsel. And Jack Kramer did as well, Bob Briner. Those guys were instrumental in how the ATP evolved and the tournaments evolved, that the tour itself evolved. And so, unfortunately, we lost Arthur way too young, and he was one of the great leaders of our ATP. And I remember him drafting the code of conduct and walking in the locker room and asking players different things about, what do you think of that, this part of the code of conduct? So he drafted that, partially because of Nastasi, because he was sick of, what Nastasi he was doing on the court. Anyway, those guys were critical to the game in the late '60s and early '70s, and even onward with Charlie. That tournament becoming one of the great tournaments in the world. It's really the fifth best tournament in the world. And that all came because of Charlie's vision of what could take place.
But you guys did something special. You stood together and you created the association. What's everyone saying to each other now? Are you disappointed that the players don't have like a clear picture of what's happening, that they're just going to go for the money? Do you think the majors have bullied around the players? What are your feelings?
Well, I think that we are at a crossroads, and the top players like, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic have all been involved in the leadership. Obviously, Federer's, no longer there. Nadal's, playing his last year, and Djokovic, he's got some different ideas of what direction it should go. And he's been pretty vocal, and he's a smart guy, and hopefully he'll push towards a good ending for the ATP tour, not ending, but the next stage of where it should go. So it's important that our leaders, we boycotted Wimbledon with all the top players, banding together. And it not only bonded us, but it also established the importance of the ATP and what the players can do if they stick together. And it's a hard thing when this money's being thrown at the players. And you've always had the economy of the top players and the next level players. You got the top 10 who are selling tickets and that everybody wants to see and that have tremendous amount of power. Then you got the next grouping of players that are pushing those top players. And then you got the bottom players and, the 40 to 150 that are out there that are at the mercy of the 250s, the 500s, and what is going to happen with the total tour in general, what tournaments are going to be out there for them to play. So it's very important that the top players have a good perspective of what should be done to keep this whole pipeline going, because you could have a great, say, a premier tour. I think they're throwing around the idea of having just the 10 big tournaments with the top players playing, but then, how those lower level players, develop and get into that eventually.
Well, that's just so it. Do you have any feel for what happens to Borstad, Gstaad, Vienna? What happens to? No, you don't.
I don't know. I mean, it could go the wrong way, or those tournaments work really hard. And those are some of the ones you just mentioned. Some of my favorite tournaments I played. Vienna was great. That Fisher was one of the great sponsors. I used the Fisher racket for about 5 or 6 years, and they were important in that. And those sponsors that are out there that really want to help, but also they don't want to lose money, you know, with a situation that doesn't make sense for them. So those tournaments are important, and it's a worldwide game. And, you know, the Saudis are involved, but, you know,
But what you said earlier that they've done of that, they haven't elevated golf. If anything, they've kneecapped golf. Nobody's watching any golf, and their events are terrible.
It's really, it's decimated the fabric of that. I mean, it's just the idea of players getting guarantees. Now, we've had guarantees over the years for years and years, but the tour itself has been built upon players playing. If they play well, they make it. If they don't play well, they don't do well. And all of a sudden you've got these golfers that are, you know, getting these huge amounts of money and
hundreds of millions.
They don't care too much about whether they win or lose after that. I mean, it depends upon their own personalities and that sort of thing, but it is, we have a tournament. We just had a tournament here. I'm a trustee on the board of the foundation that helps run the tournament, and RBC is been our sponsor, and Boeing. Nobody knows, you know, what's going to happen with a tour. You get great players on the tour, then you got a big number of players that are playing that lift thing, which is kind of a joke when you think about, you know, 54 holes, wearing shorts, playing music, and having team competition, which Rahm was so, you know, supportive of, and one of the reasons he signed it, and that, which is crazy. So you're not having guys fighting it to the end. I mean, I always bring up the thing when we first started in 68, you know, tennis became open. And so all the tournaments we played in the summertime that were amateur tournaments that I played in college, I got to play in. Then all of a sudden they were pro tournaments. And the total prize money for each of those tournaments was about $25,000. And they came to guys like Arthur and I and said, Arthur, you know, we'll give you $5,000 to play the tournament. And, you know, as a guarantee, and, you know, it doesn't matter how you do. And we said, look, let's put the money, put those 5,000s into the pot to make it 25. If we won the tournament at 25, you'd win about 5,000. But you had to win the tournament. It wasn't just showing up and on your reputation. So, you know, it's the same today, but it's, much bigger numbers you're talking about. And if the players end up going to, like the golfers, into these situations where they're getting millions of dollars just to show up, it'll kill the competitiveness of the tour.
Let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10 ball scramble. We go fast. I just say it and you say what comes in your mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
What are you gonna wear to the premiere? Are you wearing Adidas with Gucci? Gucci for Adidas?
No, I don't think so. I did that before. I'm going to wear kind of a blue suit with a white shirt. Pretty traditional stuff.
Your favorite shoes?
Well, I got some blue suede shoes, which have kind of been sentimental to me over the years. And then some that I designed myself with the tennis ball, yellow fuzz in the back of these black cracked leather shoes.
Cracked leather stands.
Yeah.
That's cool. Do you know how many pairs have been sold in the world?
Well, last year they just went over 100 million.
Come on. That's incredible. 100 million pairs of Stan Smiths. Your name on the back of 100 million pairs of shoes.
Yeah, well, most people don't know who I am, but they know my name.
No doubt. Your favorite racket?
I had to go back to my the Wilson Stan Smith. It's actually in this cabinet here. They wanted me to do this in front of it. In fact, you can see the edge of it.
Yeah, I see it. I see it all. It looks good.
They wanted me to do this in front of these different things in front of this cabinet. So the Wilson Stan Smith.
And the size of your grip?
4 7/8.
4 7/8.
Yeah, you know, Ken Rosewall, who's a, you know, slight guy, small hands, he used to use a 4 7/8 too.
7/8. I didn't even know that made a 7/8, Dan.
They did, but they don't now.
They don't make a 7/8 anymore.
No, I had to nail the grips in. First of all, I had to nail the plastic caps that go on the wood, four different sides, and then I nailed on the four other sides the grip into the wood so it wouldn't come off, because I kind of put pressure on the grip as I served, and so I put four little tacks in the bottom of the racket.
4 7/8, my man. Unbelievable. And how'd you string the racket?
I usually strung it at about 56 pounds, I think it was. You know,
natural gut. It was
a natural gut, much smaller. At Wimbledon, I used 17 gauge, and that gave me some good feel. Who was it that started experimenting with different stringing patterns? He actually worked with Lendl quite a bit. Warren Bosworth. He experimented with, you know, missing a string on the bottom of my, to give you more, a little more feel.
You worked with Bosworth.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
He just, he came up and said, look, you know, I got some ideas on this racket, is the string that can, you know, maybe give you a little more feel for, you know, your game. And he was a kind of a stringing genius guru.
Did you have a contract with him at any time? Did that happen?
No. It was just sort of I think it was the very beginning of his involvement in the game.
Wow. This is so good information.
Yeah.
This is cool. Stan, college tennis.
Well, I got to say that, I don't know if you know this, but my son Ramsey is the coach at Duke. And he was ACC coach of the year last year. And college tennis is, I think it's frustrating for coaches right now. You got the portal and the NIL. Of course, it's in all the sports, but it's even infiltrating into tennis. And you got some big programs from these big schools that are throwing some big money into tennis, as well as football, basketball, and all the other sports. And so it is frustrating to see that where, you know, again, you get a player who has a bad week and he says, I'm going in the portal, so-and-so is offering me X money to come play in college. And, you know, it's totally foreign to what I grew up in, and really until the last couple of years, is to, you know, if you were unhappy, you'd go to the coach, and the coach would have to give you permission to go in the portal. If you're in the same conference, you couldn't play for a year. But now it's, I talked to a president of a university, actually Georgia Southern, which is just up the road here from us. And he's saying, this is kind of the Wild West right now. He's kind of talking about basketball and football, but, you know, right now there's supposed to be groups outside the college that puts money into players that are already there because of what they've done in their name. But now he thinks it's going to filter through the school and be part of the school funding of those players. And it's going to change a bit, you know, in the next couple of years, but it's still the Wild West, where you get these, you know, big schools that are going to be dominating. It's a little sad.
Are you a supporter of college tennis? Do you believe in college tennis?
I really do. But what I'm seeing now is pay to play sort of thing in college, and the diploma seems to be fading away even more than it has in the past with some football and basketball, particularly those programs. But in tennis, it's actually a great path. The competition in tennis now is quite good, and players can take that path of going to college, whether they're U.S. or foreign, and really develop with good coaching, unbelievable facilities, you know, fantastic facilities for strength training and fitness, and having other players you can play with, great courts, great competition, really, against other schools. And so unless you're really special, you should be going to college. And it's an unbelievable opportunity to develop. And otherwise, you're out there maybe on your own or with a couple other guys trying to find a coach that's going to travel with you and trying to find a place you can do fitness as well as work on your game. And it is really hard unless you're really special and you get some sponsorship that's going to help pay for all that you have to deal with.
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you could make a change in the sport with just a swing of the racket, with no aggravation, what would it be?
You mean in the direction of the game, or?
It could be anything you want. It could be, it's king of the court. You're the king. You could do whatever you want.
The college tennis has been interesting with this no ad situation and a no let situation. It's pretty darn exciting when it gets down to the end of the match, particularly. So again, that's a nice development situation, and they've condensed the match into about 2 to 2.5, 3 hours max, which is good to get fans out there. That part of it, I kind of like. This whole NIL and portal is I don't know what you can do to reverse that trend right now for college. And on the pro level, you know, I like the idea of the players playing against each other more often, top players. I don't know if I would support a Premier League where you have those players playing 10 events. That's what LIV is doing. They're playing, you know, one event a month. And it's, of course, they're playing with those guys and they're playing a different format and it's not on TV. I mean, I don't even know how they're doing over there. I would not like to see that in tennis. I would love to be able to see all the players get together and to support, you know, the top 200, 300 players and not look at this golden goose that's out there that can fatten the pockets of those top players and not really help develop that whole process of going from junior tennis into the pro game. It's definitely a pro game now. I mean, it's a business, and it's so you can't just look at it and say, "Oh, I hope you know players will play anywhere they want and do whatever they want and not get paid or all this sort of thing." But I'm afraid I don't have any specific things that, except for the fact that the tour itself has got to get together with the slams because they hold quite a bit of power in what direction we're going to go and, you know, work together to get the tour and the slams going in the same direction because the slams ultimately will be hurt if the tour is not strong.
Sage advice from the Hall of Famer, a true statesman of our sport. What are the brass tacks on the documentary? Do you know the states and the cities and the schedule? Can you give me something before we say goodbye?
It's got theaters now in about 50 markets, and some are, you know, one-day events, some are seven-day events. And so I think it's going to be shown like 529 times around the U.S., particularly in May and maybe in July. I'm going to be in L.A. with my wife, Margie, on the 3rd, and then New York on the 10th. Hilton Head on the 14th, Newport in July during the tournament. We're going to be there and host a premiere there. And there's people can go online, www.whoisstansmith.com, and see all the locations of where it's going to be shown. So it's a new experience.
This has been a pleasure. Good luck with the film. You know, you mentioned your wife. The film is really a glorious love story in addition to a chronicling of your career.
I appreciate your help with that whole thing.
It was an honor to have some involvement. Last question for you. Do you have any sage advice? How do you keep a marriage going for 60 years?
It's only been 49 and a half.
But, sorry, 49 and a half. I didn't mean to age you so badly.
Hopefully it'll be 60 years. But, you know, we've both been supportive of each other. She's been unbelievably supportive of me. I had to deal with not only her game, but watching our kids play and in college and watch me on the tour. And so she's sacrificed a lot to make it work. And she had a good attitude about being on the road and a good attitude about being at home wherever we are. She looks at the positive side of it. So, and we've got these 4 great kids and their spouses and 17 grandchildren that make, bless our lives every day.
Stan Smith, what a great story.
Enjoy Wimbledon or Ojai. That's going to be fun. I will think about that. It's, and drink a little bit of orange juice for me as well.
Indeed. Thank you, Stan.
Thank you.
Huge thank you to Stan Smith. If you want to see the film, go to whoisstansmith.com. And thank you to Diadora. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at hollybirdsports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. Scopesports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. See them at scopesports.io. Denzel edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.